Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of The Demimong. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Paul.
And I am your host, Em. All right, we are discussing Penny Dreadful Season 3, Episode 4, A Blade of Grass. This episode was written by John Logan and directed by Toa Fraser. Any thoughts on this episode before we get started?
It might be my favorite episode of Penny Dreadful ever. I think Eva Green and Rory Kinnear, and the writer put together an absolute masterpiece of acting, and it was just every minute was just I couldn't turn my eyes from it. You know, it just had me on the edge of my seat, and they take you through this like symphony of emotions. You know, at one point you're like mad at them, you're pissed at them, then the devil and Dracula show up. It was absolutely wonderful, and it all took place in an insane asylum room. You know, it was beautiful.
I agree. I didn't know if you were going to like this one or not, honestly. I was kind of like going back and forth. I was like, I wonder if Paul's going to like this one or be like, well, you know, it wore on you. They took a big risk. This was a big gambit to try to do something like this, to have two characters inside of a room for an hour and to just be able to pull it off. I mean, they're really going to have to bring it with the acting, with everything. And they did. They pulled it off. It's amazing. And they try an episode similar to this every season, and I think this is the best one so far, easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they should both win like some kind of Emmy or an award for what they did tonight. Yeah.
I was telling them the other night, I was like, whatever award they give for people who act real good, that's what they should get.
Absolutely.
Whatever that's called. I don't know.
It really was. It was beautiful.
I had a hard time knowing how I felt about it after first watch. There were some things that I had a little bit of a negative response to, but overall I enjoyed the whole episode, and the more I watched it as I was writing the recap and as I did some research, some things made sense about, you know, regarding some of the things that annoyed me, like the shadows of the snake and the bat. At first I didn't really care for that, but then once I found out about the name of the poem that's being read, I'm like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. So, but we'll get into that. So anything else you guys want to say before we move on?
No, we'll get to everything that we need to talk about.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks for the iTunes reviews.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The piece is in the kiln. So hopefully Sunday afternoon when I open her up after work, I'll have it posted on Twitter. And, of course, it'll be on the No Ship, at No Ship on Twitter and at Molten Forge. I'll throw it on mine so you guys can see what you're working for. And if you haven't put a review in, do it. Damn it.
It really makes our day when we get up and we check it and we're all like, oh, look, we got another review. Somebody liked this. And then it's just really, it does wonders for us. And it makes us, that's the stuff that really makes us want to
keep going. It gets us noticed. You know, the higher we are on the charts, the more people listen and the more it drives us to keep bringing you content.
All right. This episode opens back in Seward's office. Seward asks Ives, tell me about him, referring to the orderly. She asks if he was the only person who came into that room during the five-month period of Ives' stay there, and Ives says yes. After being prompt, Ives begins to describe his appearance. She begins with his round, pleasant face and his blue eyes. When she remarks on his close-cropped hair, we begin to hear what sounds like popcorn popping in the background. But Ives did comment on the color of JC's eyes last season, right, when they met in the color award? Because wasn't his eyes like blossoms or fire blossoms or something like that? So that popcorn sound I described is actually Ives within her memory dragging her nails down the fabric of her padded wall. Clanking metal is then heard and enters a backlit John Clare, who's now the orderly. He's bringing food for Miss Ives. The lighting's very interesting throughout this whole episode. This particular scene opens with utter darkness, and then we have a soft penumbral light that illuminates only her face, and she looks desperate and focused at the same time. When he enters, the lighting of the room then brightens and continues to stay at that fairly low intensity after he leaves. So I think the narrow focus of the lighting when this scene opens was not only an artful way of revealing the source of that sound, but also showing us a window into her obsessed mind. And maybe it is also, I think actually more likely, it's to present Ives still uncovering this memory, and we are essentially seeing the shrouds being lifted, you know, shroud at a time.
Oh, I like that.
That's a good, Yeah, I like that too. That's a good way to put it, because if you don't explain it some way, shape, or form like that, then it seems inconsistent, because later on she's actually talking to JC about how the light never goes out, so she doesn't know if it's day or night. There's no windows or anything. So
right. Yeah, like you're saying, it goes against the fact that the mm-hmm. light's always on. So it's used in a way to explain, I think, the present day Ives interacting with his memory. Ives does not eat her food, but opts to continue scratching instead. John Clare, we're just going to call him John Clare.
Yeah, absolutely.
He returns and takes away the full plate. He then returns again with food and finds her standing closer to the door and staring at him as he enters the room. And she's emitting these sounds that remind me of The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
And it also has this, and also reminds me of my cat Jenkins anytime he sees another cat outside or a yes. squirrel. It's the low rumble before it really gets mm-hmm. before he gets really super upset. So she's kind of like her animal self right now, I would say.
Yeah, very feral for sure.
He tells her that she must eat. Seward's voice suddenly breaks in and asks, "Why did you not eat?" Ives asks, "Why are you here?" Seward explains that Ives' mind is now between both worlds, and it's made me think of the Demimonde, actually. Mm-hmm. Because the Demimonde's like a half world, right?
Yeah.
A shadow world.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be some sort of correlation to that, or not correlation, maybe that's the wrong word, but there's got to be some sort of connection to that, because mm-hmm. she's in the present time and she's in the past. So it's denoting that things can happen here, and they
yes.
do. Eva Green gave a stare towards John Clare that rivals Linda Blair.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if Linda Blair's watching this, she's mm-hmm. probably jealous. She's like, oh, man. I got to call up Friedkin and see if we can do another one, because this is bullshit.
It's on now, girl.
It'd be like they should have like a Pitch Perfect, like stare off.
Like a possession off.
You mean a Pitch Perfect rap off, musical off?
That would be awesome to hear either one of them rap. I would pay for that.
I don't know.
So Ive says she did not eat because she wanted to die. She at first says it is because she betrayed Mina, but then she admits that it is really because she was touched by Satan. She believes that she was evil and that there was another demon.
So do you think that she's going, okay, she's kind of taking like the psychologist route at first, like, oh, I was doing this. And then she's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm telling the truth. I was touched by the devil. This happened. He has an influence over me. I'm just going to get this joke out of the way, but Dr. Seward pulls out the little devil doll and says, show me on the doll where Satan touched you. All right, you guys.
It doesn't have one.
You guys knew this was coming. Come on.
It doesn't have
one. All right.
Well, I mean, that and, you know, she also did have the guilt for what happened with Mina. So when you're in a position like that, everything that's going on in your head is just going to come to the forefront regardless, because, I mean, you're just spinning in your own mind in a room with nothing.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with the guilt that you just mentioned, mm-hmm. Paul. And then she later brings all this up with JC, and she mm-hmm. talks about how she might have not even tried to resist Satan, you know, like almost allowed all that to happen. And we'll get to it later, but I did a search where I wanted to know about mirrors and half-world, and I ended up coming across an Alfred Tennyson poem, The Lady of Shalott, and I believe that this is connected.
Cool.
We'll talk more about that at the end. So
okay, awesome.
So now JC is back telling Ives, if she does not eat, there will be consequences. The consequences is a brutal depiction of force-feeding, as we see, and this is also a part of John Clare's job description, which is, I would not be able to do that to anybody.
Well, it's surprising they've got one person doing it. So he was pretty strong before he turned into Frankenstein's monster. So he's got some guns. It's, guns out, suns out, you know.
I don't know how things were done back then, but it just seems like you'd want a doctor overseeing that.
Yeah, or at least a couple people helping, either way.
Potential to, like, abrade soft tissue when he's intubing her, or whatever mm-hmm. you want to call that. I mean, there's a lot going on. I mean, it's metal, right?
No, it looked like a rubber hose, wasn't it?
It's called a gavage. G-A-V-A-G-E. And what you're doing is you're supplying nutritional sustenance through a small plastic feeding tube, and that tube is called the gavage. And I did a little bit of research on this, and I couldn't find too much from back then, but there was a Soviet dissident who had wrote some stuff down, and he was talking about getting done with one of those, and he said that the doctor who was forced to give it to him was crying while she was doing it because she had to keep pushing and keep pushing, and he couldn't breathe. And then she cracked some of his cartilage and had to keep going. And he couldn't breathe until she got the tube all the way down into his stomach. Then they started pouring in everything, and it was just this nasty, like, cabbage stew shit. And he said, which was really bad practice anyway, because if some of that got into his lungs, he could get pneumonia. And I mean,
right.
And then they had to leave it in there to let everything digest, because if he puked it back up, then they'd have to start the whole process over.
I don't know. I mean, it's probably the. I mean, they kind of do the same thing nowadays when they pump people's stomachs out, right? Like if they OD, they put carbon in, like it's like a carbon in your stomach to absorb a lot of the drugs.
Yeah.
And then they suck it all out.
Okay. So later, John Clare enters the White Room to exchange her chamber pot. We see him later mopping her room, and then he brings her more food. He sets it on the floor in the center of the room, and then he sits. She tells him to bring it to him, and he says no. And I noticed, like, the third time I watched it, she was sitting on her bed when he exchanges her chamber pot, and she's scratching her knees. And then later you can see there's a more of an up-close shot of her, and you can see there's scratch marks on the back of her hand, and you can also see them on her neck and her face. And so, you know, when she first goes to see Dr. Seward, she's still scratching her hands. So it's almost like she's threatening to revert back to this particular time in her life, this sort of madness where it's almost like she's trying to scratch away or maybe even get inside to who she is. I don't know. I mean, I haven't really thought too deeply about that part, but I did notice those scratches.
Yeah. Just a tick, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely a tick. But I like to add the poetic part to it.
It's poetic.
Well, I mean, you hope, but it's just how crazy goes. Look at meth heads and people who are on drugs and not sleeping. And, you know, you see a lot of the same thing. It's awful.
Yeah. But if you're talking about reality, it's just a tick. But when you're talking about a John Logan written show,
right, more than that. I agree.
There's going to be the element.
Yeah. So Ives insists that he brings the food to her. And he continues to say no, saying it is only 3 feet away. She says she is tired and that they tortured her. He argues that they were not torturing her, they were helping her, which is probably what made it easy for him to do the intubing with the force feeding.
Yeah.
He says with trepidation that she is to begin other treatments tomorrow. She asks whether it is day or night, and he tells her the answer she prefers, which at this moment is night. And we've already talked about how the light's never off and that there's no window. So at this point, she stands and demands that he brings her the food, saying she will collapse. He is unyielding. She says, "You think I'm a spoiled bitch." And he says, "They are not to engage in conversation." She asks, "What is the treatment tomorrow?" And he answers, "Hydrotherapy."
All right. Before we go into hydrotherapy, the thing that I liked about this scene is that you have to really think about the fact that Vanessa comes from some money. And so she's in the place she's at is probably pretty posh by Victorian standards. So in 1892, if you had some money and you were going bonkers, you were probably put in a place like this. You weren't going to end up with Dr. Jekyll and Bedlam as one of his subjects.
Oh,
you know,
for
chained
sure.
to a wall. You're here where people are actually doing whatever passed for state of the art science at that time. Mm-hmm. So that's why she's asking him that. You think I'm a spoiled bitch, don't you? And I mean, his body language basically says, yes, I do actually. Now that we're on the subject, but I can't talk to you about it because it's against regulations, miss.
Well, she has a hang up about it, which when the first time she meets Dr. Seward, she tries to downplay the fact that she has money. And Dr. Seward's like, why be embarrassed about that? So,
yeah,
I think, you know, it's part of her dark root.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. So she's got a chip on her shoulder for being a rich girl.
Mm-hmm. Plus, it's the whole thing with JC right now, it's just a battle of wills, too, though. Who's going to break first? You know, how bad do you want me to eat? Bring it to me. Fuck no. You know, get your own food. It's kind of like take the first steps into recovery by getting it yourself, not by make me bring it to you. I'm not your butler, which is why she goes to anything. I'm a spoiled bitch. Well, yeah, I'm not your fucking butler. Eat your food.
And it's also against regulations because I need to be 3 feet away from you because you're crazy.
At all times.
Yeah. And considering she's looked at him the last, you know, who knows how long, that like she wants to gouge his eyes out, I wouldn't bring it to her either. I probably wouldn't even be in the damn room. I'd put the food in and kick it to her.
Yeah, push it with your foot. Be like, here you go, bitch.
Fuck that. Yeah.
So hydrotherapy, pretty interesting stuff here. First of all, we've seen her get the hydrotherapy back in a previous season. I think it was
season one, right?
Season one or two, whichever episode was had the closer than sisters.
That's season one.
So it'd be season one.
Yeah.
And what they did to her at the time is they make you stand in like almost like a Jesus Christ pose, and they just turn the hose on you and just spray you down. Remember they did that right before they cracked her head open? Mm-hmm. That's called it's actually called a Scotch hose, which it either sounds like a drink or like one of those, you know, like a
a Scottish hoe.
You know, like they have those things like a donkey punch or something stupid like that. You know what I mean? It's a a Scotch hose.
Some kind of weird.
What does that mean?
Kind of weird sexual thing.
So hydrotherapy, basically, you're taking the patient, and I put patient in quotations because this is more like torture than anything else. And you're doing anything from mummifying the person in towels that were soaked in ice cold water.
Damn.
All the way to requiring patients to be submerged in a bath that's that cold for hours or even days. And they're only let out when they have to use the restroom.
Fuck.
So we, you know, it's kind of cool because if you think about that episode Closer Than Sisters, if you're to watch these two in tandem and splice them up, you could actually see they're probably tailor-made to fit each other. So you could you could pause it at one point and play the scene where she's actually getting the Scotch hose done to her.
Was there a rationale behind that?
The rationale is basically that you're trying to shock somebody out of... Dude, this was like electroshock therapy before there was electricity that was widespread. So they're, you know, and they would use it in different ways too. If somebody was acting like crazy and just had so much energy, they would actually put them in a warm bath to try to like bring them down and relax them, you know. And then if people were acting lethargic and just couldn't snap out of something, they would do the ice stuff to try to get them to be ice. Like, whoa, fuck. You know.
That was barbaric.
Nowadays, they actually use some of the tenets of hydrotherapy for like in spa settings and stuff like that. Obviously, you're not going to get the Scotch hose, but
yeah. You know, well, I mean, even in sports medicine, they, you know, sore muscles and stuff, they put them in like an ice bath like that. But it's all voluntary.
Yeah, it's voluntary, and it doesn't have too much to do with their psychological state. It's a completely physical thing.
That would suck, somebody dragging you out of your room and throwing you in the bathtub full of ice.
Fuck. And you're sitting there for hours. I mean, talk about chill to the bone.
Or just a fire hose. Remember the beginning, the scene in Rambo? First Blood, when they do that to him?
First Blood.
Yeah, and they have him in there. And instead of making him take a shower, they like hit him with the fire hose.
And Andy Dufresne gets that treatment, doesn't he?
I think so,
The lice treatment.
Then the lysing powder, yeah.
So next scene, we see her shivering after the hydrotherapy treatment. John Clare enters and exchanges her chamber pot. Later, he brings her a blanket, which looked like it felt like heaven to her. He returns again and now needs the blanket back. It must be the end of his shift. She begins to weep and says she will die. He says she is not supposed to have it in case she hangs herself. He apologizes and she says he is not sorry at all. She thrusts the blanket at him and he turns to leave. She jumps on his back, attacking him. He gains control, then leaves the room. She weeps, kneeling at the closed door.
I really like this scene because they kind of trick you at first because you think that, or I did anyway, it tricked me. I won't say you guys. I'm not saying you guys are tricked, but I was tricked into thinking that this might have been the scene where she kills him. And that's where he gets taken to the morgue, right. And then Victor's able to get his corpse. But we are robbed of that particular revelation. And thankfully so.
And of his name.
And of his name, yeah. But the part where he just hauls back like he's about to just clean her clock, and then he stops. Mm-hmm. And it really shows you the character that whoever John Clare was before it was John Clare is like. And it's so different from what Frankenstein made him, this guy who could just act in violence in any given second.
Well, it depends, because as he's gone along, he's gotten more and more gentle in that way. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like he's been killing off character. I mean, he killed that child, but he was doing it in a service.
So he's...
You know, I just think every now and then it comes out that he's still the monster.
Well, the first season, he didn't display any of that. And then the second season, we start to get that trajectory towards him becoming his own being, and now we're kind of having him come full circle back to the character who he was as the orderly, little by little by little. So it's cool that they throw that in there to let you know this is a kind person underneath it all.
Because even later on in the episode when they're sitting and it's like kind of a nice moment, I you know, there's a few moments where I imagined him as John Clare talking to her and it worked. You know, it's like, oh, you know, this is like when they are in the cholera war.
So it has a congruity to it for you then. That's cool.
Absolutely.
I would like to hear from people, because I know there's people who don't like John Clare, and I would like to know how, if this improved him for them or if it maybe lessened it even more. I would just like to know from people who feel that way.
And we're also going to need your email address, because Daniel is going to need to have some words with you.
Next scene, sitting on her bed and now wearing a straitjacket, John Clare informs her that she will be wearing the straitjacket until Dr. Benning decides it is time to take it off. Ives asks him if he thinks she is dangerous. He says no, he thinks that she is ill. She says she is not ill and talks of how they would like to see the fight taken out of her. He agrees with this sentiment and says that it is not torture what they are doing to her, but that it is science and it is meant to make her better. It is meant to make me normal, she says, like all the other women you know, compliant and obedient. And I like how he sticks up for his wife and other women when he says that his wife is not a cog or a freak after she goads him into it. Because I do think she has a point, but I think he does too.
Yeah. Well, he says you should think better of your sex. And he's right. I mean, she should. And it really shows that there's this class divide that's going on here, because she has all of these ideas that in her head. I'm not saying she's gotten them all from books. There's going to be definitely some experience here, but there's some higher learning going on in Vanessa Ives' head. But John Clare, as the orderly, is basically he's just like, well, I know from experience that my wife is neither of the things that you described, and you shouldn't think of yourself that way, which is just common salt of the earth wisdom. So I thought it was kind of cool to see these two things like butting up against each other.
Yeah. And plus they kind of, like you said, they come from different classes. So his wife probably goes and works, you know, she does more hands on, where she's used to being in that social setting where she has to act a certain way.
Yeah.
Has to be a certain way. You know, you have more money, but it seems like during the Victorian era, women had even more constraints on them when they had more money, you know?
And maybe also like being unique was a privilege. You know, you don't have time for uniqueness when you're having to work and stuff like that. You can't get away with that if you're trying to survive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's also, he probably brought all of that is what I agree with everything you guys just said. And I just also like to add that it's probably, he probably took a little bit of offense at that too, because it's just like, you know, just because we're not all part of high society and can express these things that you're talking about doesn't mean that we're freaks or cogs or anything like that. Why can't we just be people who are just as worthy of anything as you are?
But I do understand that, you know, they're trying to force her into something she's not.
Yeah.
You know, she does display some crazy, crazy behavior that's not safe for society.
No.
Because the meeting she had with Dr. Banning in season one, you know, she...
Yeah, she's like,
who's freaky?
Who's Vanessa? You know, I mean, I'm not saying they shouldn't be doing a lot of that shit that they did to her, for sure. But she should probably be under some sort of supervision at this point in her life, because she's not right.
So now at this point is when she says, God has forgotten her and he can't find her in that room. She says she is not Vanessa Ives there and that she is no one. She has no name. No purpose. He asks her if she wants a purpose, and she responds with, don't you? He says he is doing it. Wonder if this has anything to do with his overall purpose in this story. I don't know if you guys had any thoughts on that. On what she said.
Could be.
I hadn't really thought about it, but I mean, are you like saying that taking care of people or taking care of her is actually his calling or his purpose?
I would say her.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be sweet if he gets his memory back and she actually does the Superman Clark Kent put together. Because she hasn't yet. It was like, come on, you know, you should have said it. The first time you looked at her, it should have been like, Huh. It's not so pasty John Clare.
Yeah, but she didn't recognize Lily either, and she met Brona briefly, however.
I know.
I hope they remember it at the same time. Like when they right. when they meet each other yeah. next, it's far enough into the season where they're like,
hey. They both just point at each other, yeah, are you?
And they run into each other's arms. I would love that. I'm saying that with seriousness and silliness.
Yeah, well, we've got to deal with Dracula tearing that dude apart, I think.
I think
he's the one who kills John Clare. Yeah.
No, what?
Yeah, no. I think not now. I'm talking that's what kills him later down the road, like not in the this past. Season. No, that's what kills him, so he turns into.
Ah.
So he's in the cemetery for Victor to come and get
him. Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. All right. So the orderly dies at the hands of Dracula somehow.
Yeah, because it's right around that time, because John Clare's memories right now are just about him and his son building that boat. So to me, right after he leaves and she has that done, that's right when something happens to him and kills him, because we haven't gotten any memories after that point from him yet. Now, I could be wrong because they don't want to show it to us, but that's just how I feel like, because, I mean, you pretty much, the devil and Dracula both use your body, kind of. They know who you are, and neither of them are going to be too fond of you, because he's super nice and a good person, you know? So maybe he pisses one of them off, or I just think that after he leaves is when he dies.
I could totally see that, because now, like Dracula tries to go back into the room, but she's unresponsive because of all the shit they've been doing to shrink her mm-hmm. head. And then so he tries to do, like, a Renfield on him, and meets him in a dark alley, and he's like, tell me about Ives. And he's like, screw you, pal. And then he just kills
yeah,
him.
Yeah, something to this effect. I think he definitely gets whacked right after, because the time frame is also right, too, because, you know, Victor's got to get him, and then he's got to let him go. And, mm-hmm. you know, so it just kind of fits for me this way.
That's a really good idea. Mm-hmm. I hope that happens. Mm-hmm. That would be sweet. And then he would have that much more, like, animosity towards him.
Cool. Mm-hmm.
And he'd have the Hulk smash ready to go.
Or his minions tear him apart. Who knows? Yeah. I'm just saying. Yeah. I think that this is one of the reasons. Because he gets... If you look at his scars when he's JC, there's a lot of them.
It looks like it was a lot of head trauma. So yeah. Dracula bashes his head. And if it's Dracula, it's like out of anger probably. So, I think you're onto something. Okay. Now, Ives asks, is it day or night? And this time she prefers that it's day. It's as if he's giving her hope, lifting her spirits now. Ives asks his name, and he says it's against regulations. She points out that he knows her name, and he chides her good-naturedly, saying, you just told me you don't have a name. She says she was being poetic. We learn here that he does not like poetry. What he does like is not being attacked at work.
I think we can all agree on that.
Mm-hmm.
I like that, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't like being attacked anywhere, let alone at work.
Yeah, yeah. Not when I'm on the clock, at least.
So we learn that he developed this taste for poetry posthumously.
He's a tortured soul. Tortured emo soul.
Well, he had to entertain himself, because wasn't he locked away with Victor's books for the longest time?
Yeah.
And so that's that's where it developed, I guess.
And he's so ugly, nobody will be his friend. So you might as well go into poetry and books and stuff. So
he tries to convince Ives that she must try to get better so she can avoid the future treatments. He says they only get worse. And Ives asks, how can she get better if she is not ill to begin with? In other words, the powers that be are not allowing her to be who she is. And I think that's important to point out, because the whole be who you are thing is a mm-hmm. huge theme this season. So John Clare asks, well, if you are not ill, then what are you? Ives says she was touched by Satan, and her weakness allowed it because her faith was not strong enough, nor did she fight him with strength. Throughout this conversation, he has been feeding her with a wooden spoon he has brought from home.
So this is where you first start to see that he actually cares about her, because he talks about feeding his son with the same spoon because the metal hurts his mouth.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is the warm fuzzies we're getting off him, you know, because, you know, not even 10 minutes before the scene, he's like, I can't have a relationship, but you sure are spending a lot of time in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Does he not have other patients to look after? I wonder.
He neglects everyone else.
They're just dying in the next cell over. Where's my fucking dinner?
So after learning that he has a son who is ill, she asks the son's name. Sharing his name would be against regulations, of course. He tells her she must get better and begins to exit the room. As he approaches the door, he tells her that he believes her about Lucifer because he was there. When he turns to look at her, we see that his eyes are completely black and a snake's rattle can be heard. Lucifer says, "Oh, my dear, we have so much to catch up on, do we not?" And remember, Donuts pointed out that Cascabel means rattlesnake, and the Marshal Ostow referred to the Southwest as the devil's asshole also.
Oh, for sure. And, I mean, even in the Bible, Satan's referred to as a, you know, a viper. So it's really cool that they use that throughout the episode. It's a great, great way to do it. It's pretty cool.
So maybe we'll see Lucifer in the Southwest.
That'd be awesome. That'd be awesome. When this happened, I was actually working in the studio, and I turned my back for like a second and turned around right, and I missed what he had said and just saw his eyes all black and was like, what the... Oh, shit. And, you know, got cleaned my hands off and rewound it. And was like, that's fucking genius. It was awesome. I didn't expect it at all. I was expecting someone else to be either Dracula. You know, I didn't even think the devil was going to show up.
Well, it's awesome. We actually were discussing last episode who the other was. And I think you and I had thought it was JC, but Steve was the one who pointed out that it would be Satan.
This evil spawn of Satan. Dr. Satan.
Do the church lady. Could it be Satan?
Isn't that special?
If all that stuff you guys are talking about with the devil and everything and the rattlesnake and the devil's asshole and the whole nine yards being true about the West, do you think that the devil is setting up a trap for Ethan because he wants to get the Lupus Dei out of the way?
Well, he's got one of his acolytes already there, right? Doesn't Hecate work for the devil?
Yep.
Technically, yes. Hecate's on the payroll. I mean, he definitely has her W-2 on file, but it's the thing is, she's got her own agenda. She's going to go with the person she feels she has the best. If she feels like Ethan could fulfill some sort of destiny and do some crazy shit, she's going to stay by his side, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So
you don't think she's going to turn on the devil, though. I mean, come on. You got a giant pentagram branded into your body.
True.
I think she would pay a huge price if she did turn on him.
Yeah, she'd lose all of her powers, right?
It almost feels like she's trying to say that if Ethan goes dark, he could take the devil's place and then try to reclaim the throne of heaven. Just putting that out there. I don't know. That's
possible.
That's what would make it worth her while to like, you know.
See, I just look at it. She's trying to get Ethan there so they can be like lieutenants. Like, okay. You're going to have Ives and the devil. And then you're going to have us two just wreaking havoc. As well be the right hand of the devil than in his path kind of thing.
That's, you know, pretty plausible, actually. That's probably more plausible than what I'm thinking.
Because she draws all of her power from him, all of it. So she's not about to give that up. I just think she wants the Lupus Dei at her size because it's going to make her even stronger. Because think about it. If her mom had Ethan from the get-go, who knows where they'd be.
Or like she could kind of present him as a token and be like, look, you can either turn him or kill him. But it's yours to do, and look who brought him. It's me.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and plus, I think she's got this weird bestiality love for him. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There's there's some creature double feature going on there.
All right, so Dr. Seward asks what Ives had seen. She thinks that Ives is manifesting Lucifer through the orderly. Ives demands to be awoken. And Dr. Seward says she can't do it. She has tried to snap Ives out of it to no avail. She even burnt her hand with a cigarette. Dr. Seward believes that Ives is in a fugue state. Lost highway, anyone? It's not really the same thing, but it did start in a cell. Dr. Seward admits that there is a lot that is not understood in her field and that what Ives is possibly experiencing is a mental and physical break, a disassociation with your bodily functions, something like a coma.
Yeah, she's freaking out right now.
Yeah.
I hurt you. I slapped you and I burnt you.
And this is interesting because we already had, you know, reference to her being where the two worlds are kind of split. She's in between two worlds. Mm-hmm. And now she's actually split herself. She's got a mental and physical break. And then when, you know, she encounters both Lucifer and Dracula, she refers to Lucifer as the spirit and Dracula as the animal. So, because they were once one and they were split. Mm-hmm. And it's also like the conversation that Jekyll and Victor were having about the angel and the beast. So, there's a lot of that going on in this season. And you guys have anything to say before I move on?
Just that that's where all the problems arise, is when you have to, when you take the duality too far and you say, I can be one or the other completely. That's right. When you're going to run into problems. You can't, you have to embrace the duality and be who you are. You know, we're all a mix. We're all a synthesis of all these different things. We're gray areas. That's what it means to be a human being. And when you try to deny that, you're on that road to hell that's been paved with your good intentions, is all I can say.
So Ives asks, do people die like this? Dr. Seward says, yes, but Ives won't because she just knows. Dr. Seward evokes Joan Clayton's name and asks, what would Joan say to you? Ives responds by putting her head in Dr. Seward's lap and says, be true. So Dr. Seward says, be true. You will come out of it. When you're at the heart of your trauma, when you found what you're here for, I'm not leaving you for anything in this world.
Well, now we know whose side Dr. Seward is on.
Yes.
That should be pretty clear.
Yeah.
I was worried. Yeah, I was wondering. Didn't know. But now I know.
Oh, yeah, me too. I mean, she's definitely vulnerable. If she wanted to take her out, she had plenty of time to do it.
Yeah, at this point, she could have just left her alone. Been like, all right, see you later.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. She never comes out. She just lives the rest of her life in that cell.
Yeah, her body withers.
Ugh.
The next scene opens and we see Ives back over by the fabric. She's not scratching it, but her hair is all a mess, and she's now got this bit that looks like it's made out of a washcloth.
Yeah, nasty gag.
Yeah, and strapped to her head. John Clare enters. He moves a chair over to her bed and then guides her over to sit in it. He takes that bit out of her mouth and then begins to brush her hair.
Well, even closes her mouth for her because it shows you how long.
Yeah.
It was in there. You know, she just had it stuck. And then the makeup artist did an amazing job of leaving, lines in her face where it had been strapped to her. It was really well done.
It's like her jaw was like
atrophied.
Stuck open. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just couldn't close.
Oh, it was awful.
So he now believes her treatments to be torture. He puts makeup on her and talks of his wife and how he would like to leave his job. He would not want to leave Ives anyway, not until she's better. Maybe they could walk out of there together. After he has finished applying her makeup, he pulls out a mirror and she turns away from her reflection. He begs her, please, so she looks and seems overcome by what she sees. He says, this is who you are. Please don't you forget that.
This scene was
pretty touching.
So, yeah, this scene was so great because he went through all of this. He's risking his job at this point. You know what I mean? To go in there and give this moment of kindness to this woman. Like, you know, if he was to show her reflection at that point, she would be like, fuck this, just kill me. But to get her nice looking, brush her hair, put on some makeup and everything, to see this is what's at stake. This is who you really are. Try to remember that and try to do whatever they need you to do to convince them that you're normal. You know?
Mm-hmm. And I like how they made it to where he didn't apply the makeup perfectly. It looked like a guy had put makeup on her. You know, it was a little off. You know, it made it more realistic. It was a small touch that's like, okay, I couldn't have even done that personally, but at least it just made it more realistic for me.
Yeah, it was simple materials to work with to begin with. I mean, if he had been pulling out the eyeliner and crap, they would have been crazy.
Starts putting them on himself.
But then, you know, next he pulls out the only poetry he has had around the house, and it was a gift when they had their son. And it's a collection of poems by Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and also the book that I had referenced, the kidnapped book I had referenced last episode. And two poems are quoted from, and My Shadow is the first one, and the second one is The Land of Nod. And that specific quote is, try as I like to find the way, I can never get back by day, nor can remember plain and clear the curious music that I hear. And which I just liked it, so I wanted to read it.
It's also in a Tom Waits song, Took Off to the Land of Nod.
So, you know, the other poetry that he's quoting is My Shadow, and it's a short poem, and it's really cute, actually, if you read it. And but I like it, too, because not only do we actually see shadows of Lucifer and Draculator, but it's also bringing up that whole duality concept again, the shadow being your double and especially your dark self. So now John Clare has to leave before the day shift arrives, so he disassembles her and tearfully apologizes for it all. One day, no one will touch you when you don't want to be touched, or put makeup on you, or take it off ever, ever again. He musses up her hair and puts her bit back into her mouth. She complies. He says he does not really believe in God, but he will pray for her. Before exiting, he tells her it is Christmas today. After exiting, there is a long-held close-up of Von Ives that goes immediately to black after a big fat teardrop falls down her cheek.
Sad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To just to think about spending Christmas. I mean, I complain because I have to spend Christmas at work every year, but I mean, to spend Christmas in a padded room with a bit in your mouth.
Yeah.
You know, and the only one who's shown you any kind of care or concern is an orderly. You're just like, damn. I mean, you're friends with him now, so it's all good, but still.
At the same time, he's the devil too. So, but I'm sure when that happened, she probably thought that was in her head, though. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
You start questioning your sanity regardless.
Well, she's like, I am crazy. I mean, I'm in here for a reason. So she probably doesn't know what's real.
But the prolonged shot of her face, you don't see that in television very much. In fact, you don't even see it in a lot of, you know, mainstream movies. You'll see it in independent film. So,
yeah.
You know, when it was hard for me to really absorb this episode the first time, but when I watched it again, the thing that I took away from it the most, that this is a piece of art, that this whole show is a piece of art, and it should be treated that way.
Well, it felt like I was watching a play.
Oh yeah, especially later, you know, when her and Lucifer on the ground facing each other. That's where I really felt it.
Yeah,
Each time I watched it, I think this is the most I've watched an episode. And each time I watched it, it got better and better and better. And then I started cherry picking parts that I liked after that.
There's a definite sense. You guys are right. There's a definite sense of theatrics in this, the way things are blocked and filmed and stuff, especially with that. You really do feel like you're watching a play, like you're in the front row when they're slithering on the ground towards each other. You know, they're playing night crawlers. Oh, yeah.
Nightcrawlers.
Nightcrawlers.
So now the metal door clanks open into the darkness. Vanessa's voice, pained and diminished, cries out, "I'm so lonely." We learn that her parents have quit visiting, and Vanessa believes this is the end of her life. She talks of last dances, last flowers, and also the fact that she has only been with one man. She stands up and disrobes and presses her body against John Clare. He struggles to remain unaffected, and when she begins to kiss him, he is soon kissing back. John Clare comes to his senses and ends the kiss and immediately puts her shift back on. She says she should have died a virgin, like Joan of Arc. Be true and be strong. She died singing on the funeral pyre. None of us are heroes.
You know, I kind of understand where John Clare's coming from in this sense, because Eva Green, as Vanessa Ives, she's good looking. We all know that.
Of course.
But a dirty butt is a deal breaker. And she had a dirty, dirty butt. And there's just no way that was going to happen.
I'm pretty sure everything was dirty at that point.
Exactly. But I mean, you saw it on the butt and it was like,
You've seen in other movies, and I'm sure it happens in real life, you know, guys taking advantage of people in that situation. So again, it shows us how good of a person he is, you know. Other than being the vessel for the devil, Dracula.
That's not his fault.
Everything you see here makes you fall in love with his character even more. You know, I mean, even if you don't like John Clare, you can't help but like this guy.
You
know, John Doe, whatever the fuck his name is. You know,
John Deere.
It was wonderful. You know, and that they take the twist to it later is just genius.
Well, Ives can't help her dirty, but I mean, she's only eating broth and she's probably getting backsplash from the chamber pot.
Probably getting sponge baths, if that. Who knows? Yeah. She probably smells like an onion patch.
Ugh.
It's gross.
Oh, man.
It's disgusting. But then again, they didn't have deodorant anyway back then, so maybe everybody liked it. I don't know. A lot of perfume going on.
Well, you know, you grow up with whatever you're used to, and then that's what you're used to. So if nobody smelt somebody wearing deodorant before, I mean, body odor was probably pretty tolerated back then because there wasn't too much of a way around it unless you just got out of the bath, which she obviously hasn't had, because you don't see – he's the only person who's seen her for 5 months besides the doctors when they're outside of that room. So – you never see her getting a bath that whole time. Was that just not something they did? Or, I don't know.
I just think there's no time for it right now. You just kind of take it, you know, for what it is. And they made her look extra kind of dirty at this point, you know, because she's very fair skinned and she had like a gray tone to her. Gray and dirty.
Yeah, her and the room were the same color.
Exactly. Although later throughout this episode, you get a lot of images of the floor, and the floor is immaculate.
Well, they show him mopping it quite a few, you know.
I know, like, but come on, you got a crazy person living in there. There's going to be some dirt, damn it. I liked it. It just that it always, whenever they got close to it, it was like, man, that is a clean, clean floor.
So John Clare warns that if Ives does not start to show improvement, she will have to face trepanning, which is also the same. It's this trepanation is another word for that, which I had, you know, referred to in season one when we were covering the show. This involves shaving her head, like Joan of Arc, piercing her skull, and then cracking it open. Then the good Dr. Banning will start to remove brain matter at random, from what it sounds. As a result, there is a potential for a variety of consequences involving bodily functions. Those who have faced trepanning are never the same when they come out. They are a broken thing. Not a tiger, not a flower, not a clump of dirt, not even a blade of grass. He begs her to get better. Pretend if she has to. He wants to know, is it so important to be different? She asks, if his son were to be unhappy, would he want him to pretend? And he says no. She then says, then don't ask of it of me.
If you're out in society and you're free, and somebody's asking you to put constraints on the level of uniqueness or strangeness that you have in your personality to just try to get by, it could be construed as a shitty thing to ask of somebody. But if your very life and functions depend on this, it's probably not so much, because you have to have basic things to have more things. So happiness is not an achievable goal if you can't even control your bowels. So, I mean, I think that, you know, John Clare had the better point here. She was more poetic about it, but he had the better point. Because, like, she can come back and say, would you want your son to fake stuff to be unhappy? And he'd be like, well, no, I wouldn't. But at the same time, if it was a choice between him being happy or alive and conscious, I'd go with that. Because then there's a chance for happiness some point down the road.
Which he doesn't actually say, but I wish he did. But what were you going to say?
Well, she gets it done in the first season, the actual procedure, right? Do they show it?
Yes.
They do. And it's one of the scenes from that same episode to where, like, after their last meeting in this episode, you could play that because that's what happens next, you know, and then it just go from there.
So. Nice. Because they both kind of come back from trauma like that. So it's interesting that he's saying that because, you know, he goes through whatever he goes through.
Yeah.
And then comes back and is still kind of like a good person at heart, even though, you know, he's done some shitty things. And then she's come back from it and still kind of has her base core, but they are both kind of broken.
And when they showed the trepanning, it was the left side of her head, and his wound is on his left side, too. So he begs her to let him help her. He asks her to explain why would the devil be interested in her. She asks, if you were Lucifer, why would you be interested in someone? And he responds, as Lucifer, his eyes darkened once again, because I love you. A snake rattles and Lucifer talks of trepanning and how it was used in the Dark Ages to encourage dark spirits to escape the body. I don't want you to fear me. I want you to embrace me. And this is where it really gets theatrical. And he says, of your own volition. So, you know, I had mentioned last season that he's after her will, which... her volition would be her will, and this would lead to him obtaining her soul in the end. He then tries to cleave her from her faith by sowing doubt about God's mercy. Lucifer says that she is not even a blade of grass to her God. And so you just mentioned how she had trepanning, and I'm wondering, is it a miracle of her God that she does not suffer the consequences that John reported to her after a person would be trepanned? So, or why doesn't she have that, you know, reaction to it or response?
It may not be a miracle of her faith in God. It could be some sort of protection. Look, Lucifer and Dracula both have a vested interest in keeping her healthy and safe to a certain extent, because they're still holding out for the hope that they can conjoin with her and she can become Amunet. So none of that's implied in the episode, but it just seems to follow a line of logic that I can't ignore.
Well, sometimes I'm confused about what's going on with Ives, and I have to keep reminding myself that she's not Amonet yet. She has to ascend to Amonet after the joining. So, yeah. But sometimes my mind reverts back to what I was originally thinking, where I feel like Amonet is residing inside her, that Lucifer has never actually possessed her. He's always tried to manipulate her externally, but she's got a demon inside, which is the Amonet in her. And mm-hmm. I was thinking maybe that's like propping her up. Like if she were to lose that, she would probably die of the effects of trephining.
Mm. So that would give her some sort of fortitude to be able to hold up against all of these tortures she's being put through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or God protecting her too, but who knows? I mean, we don't know. It's all speculation right now.
Well, she invokes both at the end,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting.
Talk about hedging your bets, huh?
Yeah.
I know.
So Lucifer says, let us be as we were. Before there was time, there was thee and me. Before the scorpion crawled and the adder hissed. Back to the time when the old gods sang and there was only thee and there was only me.
So remember in, I believe it was season one. It could have been season two. But John Clare, as Caliban at the time, says that to Victor. He says there's something... I wish I could remember the exact quote. I should have looked it up so I could write it down. But he says that to Victor. He says, thee and me. He uses the exact same phrase.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if there's some sort of residual thing that stayed with him after he died, that, you know, like a piece of the possession maybe, or a piece of whenever Lucifer was using him like that. And then at least if that's true, or if it could be true, then what stayed with him when Dracula did that?
Oh, man.
So Lucifer says, give to me yourself freely. And she seems game all of a sudden. And this is one of the reasons why I was kind of put off the first time, because I didn't realize she was, you know, playing along. I mm-hmm. thought she was serious. And I was like, get off the fucking floor, Ives. So she's on the floor and they face each other like a couple of sphinxes. And she asks, then what will happen? And he says, they will topple God from his throne. Cue Dracula's laughter. And now Lucifer's frightened and recoils to a corner, cowering. Wings beat, and Dracula laughs. Ives also seeks what precious little distance achievable away from this new intruder, but then regains her strength and walks to the center of the room to face him. Dracula is speaking through John Clare. In fact, there are now two John Clares in the room, but the way he uses his voice, and also the way he holds his head and
everything.
Yeah,
his mannerisms, everything is genius in the bit of acting.
The color of the eyes, because I think Dracula had the red eyes and Lucifer has the black eyes.
Roy Kinnear has, he's fantastic actor. So this duality thing just got literal. And she asks for his name and he says, you can read it on his tomb. Lucifer names him the father of beasts, the king of maggot-crawling flesh. The brothers throw insults at each other, and Dracula clearly is the dominant brother, at least in this earthly realm.
That's what I was thinking. I think that if they were in the underworld, if they were in hell, then it would be the other way around. Then Lucifer would be grabbing him and giving him noogies, you know, like, yeah, what do you think now? Huh? Who's the boss?
Do you think he's also weakened as a result of the stuff, the circumstances from last season, maybe?
I mean, this all took place before last season, though, right?
You're right.
I think that they're both kind of projecting themselves in there. You know what I mean? So they're not at full strength regardless, because I think they have to, like, I don't know if they're, because she pops out of it and John Clare's sitting there like, what, you know, asking her the same question. So to me, that they kind of like projected themselves into her mind. Like the room goes dark and all that took place, to me, just inside her brain.
Yeah.
In like a split second.
Because they show more about that. I agree with that completely.
Because they show her leaning back and there's no one around her. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And like when Dracula's about to bite. But as to the whole thing of why Dracula is more powerful, I think it's not just because he's in the mortal realm and then Lucifer's not. He's there as a spirit or whatever. I think it's also because of what he says. We live in a time of ascendant science and logic and thinking and stuff like that. So, you know, all of these things are converging to make people less superstitious. But you would think, okay, well, if they're less superstitious about the existence of the devil, wouldn't they be the same or even more so about a vampire? But it doesn't matter. He's not after her soul. He's after her flesh. So he exists for real. It doesn't matter if people believe in him, but the devil does need people to believe in him. Yeah. So it comes down to an issue of faith for one of them and an issue of like nuts and bolts physicality or flesh and blood physicality for another one.
Yeah, I like that.
But Lucifer says he is only concerned of the faith of one. Obviously, that's Ives. And you had also said that the best what's that quote you say about Satan?
Oh, the greatest trick that the devil ever pulled was making or was getting people to believe that he didn't exist. So he doesn't want everybody to believe that he exists because it works at a counter purpose to what he's trying to do. Because you can't influence somebody very easily exactly. If you know that they're trying to influence
you. If it's of the devil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So you have to be sneaky and crafty and everything. So he only cares about one person. He doesn't want everybody to believe in him, just one.
So at this, Dracula turns to Ives and talks of her dark power. Dracula does not need her soul as Lucifer does. He wants her flesh. He asks her to be his bride, and then all the world will live in darkness. The very air will be pestilence to mankind, and then our brethren, the night creatures, will emerge and feed. Such is our power. Such is our kingdom. Such is my kiss. She is down, or so she appears. He says to her, "You're the wolf. You are the scorpion. You are all those things that slip and soar and stalk through the deep forest and the dark night." It is as if he's describing her as a demimonde incarnate. And mm-hmm. I guess this is hence the name that she's given also, the mother of evil.
I do like to think that the doctor sitting there just like chain smoking through this whole part, like, holy shit, you know, just slamming drinks and chain smoking like. Just looks. I wouldn't know what to think.
Lighting
you
one cigarette with under. The other.
She's, oh yeah, yeah. Maybe even double fisting. Yeah.
She's like, Renfield, get your ass in here. Listen to this. Listen to this shit.
Oh yeah.
So basically, Dracula says all he needs is one kiss, and you'll be free of all this. He says he loves her for who she is, unlike the rest of the world who shuns her for her uniqueness. She asks him what name shall she call him. He says he is the demon, the dragon. My name is. Dracula. Ives pulls away, announcing that she sees both of them clearly now. Two brothers fallen from grace, the spirit and the animal. And these two are the embodiment of evil because neither of them are part of a whole. So that's what makes them evil, Lucifer and Dracula, because they mm-hmm. have split. And so she talks of the one who vanquished them, her protector, the one who stands with her now. They threaten her with terror, horror, and unveiled prophecies. Lucifer demands to know, "Who are you to defy me?" She responds resolutely, "I am nothing. I am no more than a blade of grass, but I am. You think you know evil? Here it stands." She then begins to speak the verbis diablo and to levitate. They both move back away from her. So she didn't learn how to speak verbis diablo until season two.
That's true.
So I'm wondering if she is influencing from the present. So if she's able to manipulate the past.
Well, you're right. I was about to say season two was like a little prequel part, but she goes back and opens it up. So you're right. So what was the question again? Sorry, I was trying to.
Is she altering history?
Possibly. I mean, her mind now is in control. And why would the devil be afraid of Verbis Diablo? And that kind of like. His shtick?
It is the devil's tongue, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's so why would the devil be cowering from it?
That's now, I agree. She used against the doll in the episode Verbis Diablo. That
it's true.
That's what she used to defeat it. It's evil versus evil.
Oh, so it's just a powerful spell.
Yeah, it's going like back, that. And there's no defense. Like you, if you're evil and somebody comes at you with good, hey, you're evil. You know what I mean? You've already got the leg mm-hmm. up. But if it's evil versus evil, then what? How do you?
I want to say that, yes, that's like in her mind now attaching to that, and that's how it was handled. But at the same time, whenever the thrall was in the Hall of Mirrors with her and he was like, you know, he was about to bite your neck and then he was with you or somebody came in. So I don't know. You know, all that could have been in Ives to begin with just because of who she is. You know what I mean? So. It's kind of it could be either way. You know, she could have had that in her and Aminette or is protecting her. You know what I mean? So there's no telling whether or not that was her adding that to history or if that was what happened.
There is the point that she did forget everything that happened in that room and she's just mm-hmm. now remembering it all. So she could have possibly somehow had that Verbis Diablo in her head And then she learns it, what she thinks, for the first time later on with the cut wife. That's possible. But see, I do like what Em's saying, though, because it kind of denotes that there's, because Vanessa Ives in present time is there as well. So maybe she's like, you know what? Screw you guys. You know what I mean? I'm going to do this. And she does that. And I think the reason why she snaps out of it is because Dracula is telling her, you are the wolf, you are the scorpion. And he fucks up because that makes her think of Ethan, and then it makes her think of Joan Clayton.
And or then, because she's so powerful that when they put her back under, she actually goes back to that time and defends herself. And it's all like a loop.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I like
that. Yeah. Lost Highway again.
Yes, yes. We're prepared for this.
But see, she brings up her protector, which I'm pretty sure she's referring to her god. And then she speaks of herself as like almost like this sort of deity of evil. So that's interesting.
Which when she floated up in the air, I thought of you, Steve. I was like, oh, I bet he's eating this up.
And she's like, I am no one.
I never get tired of watching possessed women in dirty clothes just float. It's just a big turn on of mine.
Except a little bit of vomit would have been nice.
You know? A little bit of what? Vomit? Just, yeah.
Yeah, some pea stew on Dracula.
They had the chamber pot and dirty butt, so there
that's,
you go.
Yeah, that's like the drawback. It's just, you know, I know underneath it there's a dirty butt, and I'm just like, ah. But
and then Ash busts down the door. Ring, 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 ring. Whole different show.
Give me some sugar, baby.
Yeah, right. Kisses are flowing.
So, you know, talking about her, this deity that she is, she's speaking of herself like a deity. So I feel like that kind of goes along with what I was thinking earlier about her having Aminette inside her, like Aminette's like sleeping like a little cat in her belly or something. So Ives awakens to find that she is still in the middle of this conversation with John Clare before it went dark. Instead of answering his question about why Lucifer would be interested in her, she says she would rather sleep. As he exits, he wishes he could turn the light off for her. Dr. Seward's voice comes in and says that Ives can wake up now. Ives says she is not done yet. Re-enter John Clare. Ives is bald, having been prepared for trephining. She tried to pretend to be normal, but she could not deny that God's immortal glory lives in her and everyone. This is what finalizes her sentence to trephining in the end. And it's interesting to me that Dr. Banning was more willing to believe that she had a demon inside her that needed to be released by trephining rather than believe her claims about her God.
Yeah, the guy's kind of a dick. I mean, when you get right down to it. Anybody who's going to do that to a woman is just, I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's like modern day science. We still do things that aren't. You know, if you think you're actually helping someone to make sure that you're going to do whatever you have to, you got to kind of find their trigger. And he knew, I'm sure from the get-go, that her trigger would have been her faith.
Yeah.
So you can look at him as a dick, but at the same time, he's just a doctor doing his job. Unfortunately, it was during a part of history where
it's just brutal. We thought we were helping, but, you know, there's really a big lesson there. I mean, you know, you think about the monkey who's helping the fish. You know, by putting them up on a high tree branch and saying, well, yes. I'm clearly saving you from drowning, you know? So it's like,
exactly.
You know?
I mean, 100 years from now, who knows if they're going to do the same thing for what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They gave him pills for everything.
Yeah. So stupid. They had pills that made him go to sleep, pills that made him wake up.
Mm-hmm.
So now Ives is sitting before John Clare, and he says he's leaving tomorrow because he's had second thoughts about working in that facility. He had this epiphany while working on a wooden model ship with his son. They had discussed the Arctic and that it is too cold and lonely for human habitation, which made him think of Ives in this white room. He weeps and tells her he tendered his resignation, but he will be there with her in the morning. He will be the last person she sees before her surgery, someone who loves her. She kisses him and they touch foreheads in friendship, the eternal kind of friendship. He says goodbye and leaves her room. She awakens in Seward's office. The wax cylinder spins, which is a nice bookend to Ives' wall scratching. Ives notices the cigarette burn on her hand. Dr. Seward asks what she remembers, and Ives remembers everything. She's not frightened, and she names this thing, and it is Dracula. Oh, it's on, nice. Boy.
Oh, yeah.
It's on like Donkey Kong.
I wish she had some more backup, but I guess JC's there, so maybe Frankenstein. I don't know. You know, she's definitely not rocking the same crew she had last season.
But she will at some point, because there was a little short thing in the preview where somebody is talking about, I think it might have been Malcolm, and he's talking about Vanessa needs us, and they're all heading back over to the pond, you know, to somebody's going to have to go and get, you know, Vicky and Dr. Jekyll and make sure that they're on board too.
Just to real quickly, just to go over the Lady of Shalott, I had discovered it on my lunch break today, so I didn't really get to read too much of it, but it seems kind of cool, and it is an Alfred Tennyson poem, and I think it has relevance. And so I'm going to read up more about this, but I'm going to go ahead and throw out that we need to keep an eye out for a cracked mirror.
Okay.
So we'll just establish that for now, and I promise to read up more about this because I will have time to do it in the next couple of days. All right, on to feedback.
All right, buckle up, everybody. Get in your straitjackets. It's time for Bib. Bib says, still catching my breath after the Game of Thrones. Breathe in, breathe out.
I agree, Bib. I watched it before this episode. It was pretty good.
She says, Seward, tell me about him, the orderly. Yes, please. Miss Ives, it's time for your manicure. Please stop tearing up the walls. Gads, that is unnerving. I mean, at least it wasn't a chalkboard.
Yeah. Yeah, thank goodness for that. But, you know, you get that vibration through your fingers and down your arm, and it can be kind of soothing, too, at the same time. Not saying I've spent a lot of time in a padded room doing that, but sure. I can see how you would get lost in doing that if you're...
Well, it's something to do.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. No, they don't even give her like a chess set to play with or anything.
Mm-mm.
Cannot get used to John Clare as a regular man. Oddly, the first time I ever heard about someone being force-fed was English suffragettes. Awful.
I saw the same movie. Well, I don't know if you're referring to the movie, but that's the first time I ever heard of it.
The tension building is upsetting. Almost as upsetting as Padded Room Ives. How strange, he's pretty and she isn't. Hang herself now? From what? I don't have imaginative suicide thoughts. Well, I'm assuming it would be the lights that are up there, because there's like a T-bar up there that has lights. I don't know if they're sodium lights or what.
Yeah, if it was sturdy enough, she could have used that.
Ah, it's attack Ives. Being in a straitjacket would drive me bonkers. How in the hell do you use the chamber pot? Very carefully. Very carefully.
Yeah, it's probably just sitting in the middle of the room and you...
Yeah.
What is she wiping with?
Nothing.
Oh, there's no wiping.
Nothing. Do you see that butt? I'm trying to tell you.
Maybe the bed. He's scooting on the floor.
Was it my imagination, or did that bed get longer and shorter in different scenes?
I didn't notice that.
Yeah I kind of noticed it.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I think that was a thing. Huh. Mm-hmm. Poetry love. Not born with it. Check. Oh, my damn. Where did his eyeballs go? I guess she's talking about whenever he turns into...
Mm-hmm.
Lucifer.
Seward, I'm not going to lie to you. I've hypnotized you, but I don't know how to get you out. Now I'm going to channel the co-wife.
Holy! But you're not pregnant anymore. No, I'm kidding.
<Do-do-tsh>. Holy fucking hell. I've never been so grateful to live in the 21st century in all my days. Shedding a few for Ives. This is horrible. Mm-hmm. Why are we putting makeup on the sad, tortured woman? Disturbing. So disturbing. Look, he's being nice, okay? Oh, no, I'm sorry. She says, I'm sure anyone outside my building just heard me scream, no. Don't bring up Joan of Arc again. That shit makes me crazy.
Why?
Because she was burned at the stake. And Ives, you know, the cut wife got burned at the stake, so she just doesn't want the parallels to keep going.
None of us are heroes. The orderly might be.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it so important to be different? Great damn scene. If you were Lucifer, why would you be interested in someone? Because I love you. Judas H. Christ. Rory is fucking brilliant. I'm crying more because this is freaking me out. So, two dudes are fighting over you. The bad news? They're both demon freaks. Closed captioning calls him the creature. Okay, he can't die in the hospital because he knew where to go to find his wife and child. He must have worked in the shipyard/factory there to know that. Huh, interesting point. But I think he got something out of the landlord at the last place after he pressed his head into the wall. I think that guy coughed up some information. Oh my lands, these two. I joke they were soulmates when they met underground, but damn. Seward, I am your doctor. Have a drink. Sorry about putting that cigarette out on you. I look forward to Dr. Donuts explaining this crazy-ass show to me. The end. Thank you, Bib.
Thanks, Bib.
Entertaining as always.
Thanks, Bib.
For a second, I thought she'd just say, so two dudes are fighting over you. The bad news, there is none.
All right. Next up, we got a listener writing in for the first time. His name is Alan Campbell. He says, first of all, the show inspired me to start reading Bram Stoker's Dracula, an awesome book, by the way. I'm about halfway through, and there were a couple of interesting things that tie into the show. First, Dracula is in fact able to walk during the day in the book. He just lacks his full powers during the day. Second, the recording cylinders that Dr. Seward uses in the show are straight from the book. Dr. Seward is one of the narration characters, and while the other narration characters use letters and written diaries, Dr. Seward keeps his diary of events on these recording cylinders. Awesome little shout out to the book by the show. You guys were trying to figure out if Ethan would have wolfed out on the ship. I googled transatlantic travel times, and at the end of 1892, the speed record for crossing from England to New York was 5 days, 14 hours, 24 minutes. Even on an older steamship, the crossing probably would not have taken Ethan more than a week, so he could have made it. Yeah, you're probably right about that. I think Rusk knew already because he put him in an animal cage.
Mm-hmm.
Unless that's normal mode of transport for prisoners. But it was a very small, like, size for a big dog, not for a human cage.
I think Rusk knew for sure, but he didn't get complete validation of it because there wasn't enough time on the trip. Because if it only took that long, and then they went right into a train when they got to the East Coast and headed out, it wouldn't take a whole month. So
he probably couldn't explain why they need to keep him in the cargo hold in a, you know, in a cage. It wouldn't have probably flown with the authorities over there, so he had to put him in cuffs and bring him into the passenger train.
He just threatens everybody to bitch slap him with his iron hand. Like, don't make me use this.
He just tears him up with his wit.
Alan goes on to say, I also looked up London's Chinatown. Vanessa, in her conversation with Dr. Sweet, refers to the area as Limehouse. It turns out that the Limehouse, which is in the east end of London, was London's Chinatown district during the Victorian era. It was along the Thames docks to the east of Whitechapel. Here is what Wikipedia has. The first area in London known as Chinatown was located in the Limehouse area of the east end of London. At the start of the 20th century, the Chinese population of London was concentrated in that area, setting up businesses which catered to the Chinese sailors who frequented in the docklands. The area began to become known through exaggerated reports and tales of the then-legal opium dens and slum housing, rather than the Chinese restaurants and supermarkets in the current Chinatown. There was also a reference to Lascars, who basically were Middle Eastern or Asian merchant sailors, tying into the fact that the Limehouse area is along the docks, according to Wikipedia. A Lascar was a sailor or militiaman from South Asia, the Arab world, and other territories situated to the east of the Cape of Good Hope, who were employed on European ships from the 16th century until the middle of the 20th century. Thanks, and keep up the good work. Alan Campbell, who is now Alan Quartermain.
Alan Quartermain.
Yeah, that's a lot of good information. Thank you. Some history on it.
Yeah, clearing up some of our wonderings.
Well, thanks for doing the research for us. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you for writing in. All right, up next is Stephen Chandler, who has a little bit of commentary about balls.
This is the other Stephen Chandler.
And he says, first of all, lads, let me reassure you that I was in no way questioning your testicular fortitude in my last email. I'm sure your sports cups runneth over. I mean, I'm practically pregnant listening to your podcast, and I'm a male. It's a problem, Steve. It's a problem because Paul and I have had several paternity suits over this podcast that we've had to get through, you know? A little bit of child support here and there. No, we were talking about our balls. We were saying Americans in general have, you know, we have too much balls and not enough of other good graces that, you know, a lot of other people have, it seems.
Yes, balls.
Hey, but thanks for complimenting our balls. I'll take it. I was merely chiding our wolf of God for being a victim of his circumstance instead of the raging beast that's supposed to lie within, which results in the majority of his current problems. Oh, and M, you are a picture of grace and elegance.
I wish that were true.
It is. To the episode. So I could be wrong, but does anyone else think that Kaiutne could be a skinwalker, not only after Ethan for help or revenge, but also his powers? They are most commonly male, and we've already seen that he is very mystically capable, and he did speak of wearing Ethan's scalp on his belt, not only as a trophy, but also as a talisman to the power of the wolf. Hmm. You want to say anything about that, Em? I know you had brought that up at some point, didn't you?
I think I was talking about the Wendigo. I don't think I ever brought up the skinwalker, but we had a listener write in last episode about the skin changer in reference to things that Senbene had been talking about.
Hmm.
Okay. I'm not sure how similar they are, but...
Okay. Maybe he's seeking revenge on Ethan for the slaughter that the wolf committed, but has Ethan fooled? The backstory reveal will hopefully spark some interest for me in the U.S. story that is coming next week. I could be reaching, but there's definitely more to him. Oh, yeah. I definitely think there's more to K-Town than we've seen, if that's what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. I agree. And it could go any direction. I mean, we just don't know.
I think Logan's going to bait and switch us like usual, get us to think one specific thing about him, either be real comfy with him or start to get the heebie-jeebies and then turn it right around, either way.
Exactly.
Either way, he's really acquainted with the devil's asshole, so like, we just know that.
Quality Ives and Seward time in the White Room made me a happy chappy, as great things happen when these two actresses are together. Agreed. Eva brought it in those scenes. I'd have brought her the food, the blanket, anything she damn well wanted. A black-eyed orderly tried to put St. Ives in her place, but you know you're pretty damn powerful when you can put the devil and Dracula in their place.
At the same time.
At the same damn time. JC's science is meant to make you better speech was interesting, considering Vicky was able to make a man who didn't like poetry into one that spouts it on a regular and seeks love and companionship despite now being a monster. Interesting point. It's a good point, though. The makeover scene was truly touching, and JC's urging Ives not to forget who she was, even through the meddling of science was tragically poetic. Just when you thought we couldn't love our broken thing more, right? The horror and the beauty that such science can exact. Rory Kinnear was a revelation this episode, the real John Clare. His Luciferian possession and his portrayal of Dracula proves the show has the goods in spades. He was never really on my radar before this episode, but damn, he impressed the hell out of me, and by pre-surgery goodbye scene, I was a wreck. Can't wait to see where and when Ives and JC will meet up again, but sweet Dracula will soon realize it's clobbering time. God damn right, so. Steven, you are right. It is going to be clobbering time. Hands down, one of the best episodes of the show thus far. Till next time, the ball's in your court. LOL, balls.
Nice finish.
Yeah. You bring up some really good points. And Rory Kinnear definitely deserves the Good Acting People Award.
Yeah, the only other thing I've seen him in was in the adaptation of J.K. Rowling's A Casual Vacancy, and his role was really small in that.
Well, I'm glad everybody's liking this episode so far, because I felt like it's an achievement. I mean, they really did something special here. So, you know, but I guess I shouldn't expect people not to like it, because Penny Dreadful fans are going to be a little bit more discerning than the average. You know, we're not talking about Keeping Up with the Kardashians here. So, I mean, duh.
Somebody just turned us off for that.
Yeah. I can't listen to them.
Bitch.
He also has a PS. He says, how's the irony? My dad is actually a JC too. Hope I didn't blow your damn minds. That's because we call him the other Steve, the other Chandler, and now his dad is JC.
Oh, nice.
Dude, it's like you're meant to watch this show. All right, next up, Princess Butterqueen. Hi, I'm Steve and Paul. This was one scary episode, but great. 10 little albino scorpions. I'm still amazed that 3 characters could hold my attention for an hour. I was mesmerized by Eva Green, JC, and Patti LuPone. The acting was superb, and the storyline filled in quite a few holes for me. The 2 fallen angels revealing themselves was amazing, one to hell, the other to earth. I was charmed by the Orly's compassion, although I bet Mr. Lyle would have done a better job on hair and makeup.
No.
It will be interesting to see what happens between Vanessa and JC as the orderly right before the surgery. I'm guessing it will tie into JC's original death. Hopefully he doesn't get trapeened.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Just a couple of comments. It seems like Vanessa was reciting the Verbis Diablo to Lucifer and Dracula. I always thought Vanessa went to see the cut wife after her hospitalization at the asylum. That's when Joan Clayton gave Vanessa the book and knowledge about the nightcomers. So I'm having trouble understanding the timing. So we've addressed that, but I don't know if that explains it.
Hopefully it does. I mean, at least it offers a possibility of what it could be. And if you don't buy into that, just think about the fact that she did not, up until this point, remember anything that had happened there. So it lets you know that it could have been already in her noggin.
Mm-hmm. Or it's a time loop.
Her next point is, Dr. Sweet may not be so bad after all. I wonder if Dracula is just using his body and Sweet is actually a normal but nebbishy zoologist. Of course, I'm still hoping for Vanessa and Ethan Wolfe to end up together. I think it was either Bib or Dunkin' Donuts who coined Ethan Wolfe, and I love it.
See, I agree with her. After this episode, it made me okay that Dr. Sweet was Dracula, you know, because it could possibly that, you know, he's morphed him. He can change his body into looking like Dr. Sweet, or that he's possessing Dr. Sweet. Totally made it okay for me. I'm fine with it now, because I was pretty against the Sweet Doctor being Dracula. Now it works.
But see, I don't want to ruin. Well, it wouldn't ruin it anyway. But I don't think that Dracula wasn't possessing John Clare. He was just
operating in Ives' mind, as you said earlier.
Yeah, he was inside the mind. It was just a projection. But it could still be, now that they've put that out there, you could take it in all different directions. So it could very well be that Dr. Sweet is just a normal guy, and then every now and then he has lapses in his memory because
Dracula takes him. Like, how did I break my teacup again?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Why is my knuckle broken, you know, after he punches this guy across the room?
Mm-hmm. So Princess Buttercream says, I had the subtitles on when watching the episode, and they kept referring to JC as the creature. I had to laugh. Thanks again for the great podcast, Princess Buttercream.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Princess
Buttercream. Thank you for whiting in, Buttercream.
Feedback.
Feedback.
Up next, we give a big salute to Dahlia General.
Swish.
She says, Dear M. Stephen Paul, wow, just wow. What an episode. I only watched it once and was left drained and honestly not sure if I liked it or not. I needed time to process it all. Upon reflection, here is what I netted out with many questions. I love the focus on just Vanessa and JC, although I would have loved to see some Lyle. I missed that ginger. How lovely was JC's compassion for Ives? The chemistry between the two of them has always been magical on the screen, palpable even. Mm-hmm. What a treat to see these two amazing actors together. When Dracula said to Ives, you are the wolf, you are the scorpion, what do you think he was alluding to? If she is also the wolf, as later he says, become the wolf, the bat, and the scorpion, be truly who you are, then what is the role of Lupus Dei? Can she actually protect her own self with her faith in God? Perhaps you've already covered this in the upfront. If so, next. And the refrain of be who you are, know who you are, be truly who you are. Could we have more iterations?
Oh, I bet we will.
Yeah. Is that a challenge? Because Logan is up to it. Dracula also calls himself the dragon at some point. Could this explain why we see the dragons in Chinatown when we see Sweet? Oh, interesting. John Clare also sees it twice. So
interesting.
So he's going to smash some Dracula because he's going to. That's what it's all coming to. Is Sweet just a vessel like JC to carry Dracula's spirit in? Ah, can he take many forms over the years, choosing the one that suits his victims the best? What if all of this, and I mean all three seasons, are only in Vanessa's mind, much like the Newhart show ender, Buffy's episode Normal Again, or the final episode of Saint Elsewhere? Looking forward to your thoughts on all of this. I salute you back, Dahlia General. Did you read my mind? How did you know?
That's funny you say that, because I actually had that same thought about what if this is all in Vanessa's mind, because when I was thinking about the fact that she could be the Demimonde incarnate, and I also had the same reaction as you did upon first watch, so glad I'm not the only one, Dahlia.
I will say for my part that I suppose it's possible, but I'm really not fond of those episodes. The actual episode that you're referring to in Buffy canon, Normal Again, is one of my least favorite episodes. Not because it's poorly written or acted or anything like that, but because I really do not like the premise that something would just all be in somebody's mind, because it makes
The writing's too good for that to be in this show.
It makes it all fake. So anytime you have a scene that doesn't involve directly the person whose mind it could be in, that's a tell that it's not that. You know, I'm not because
I mean? They did that on the Newhart show also.
Yeah, Bob Newhart she mentioned that on end. This. She said much like the Newhart show ender, like her season ender or whatever. So, and then St. Elsewhere, which is not a show that I ever watched, but
I watched some episodes of that. My parents watched that. I'm not advocating that it should be in her, but it did cross my mind that it's a possibility just based on things that were said in this particular episode.
On to thank you, Dahlia.
Thanks, Dahlia.
Thank you, Dahlia.
All right, up next, Double D's.
The Doctor.
Hey, Dreadfuls. How am I going to stand it this season? It just keeps getting better. It's almost too good to handle. 10 out of 10. Mind blown again. I kept hearing that Rory Kinnear has acting skills to die for, and while I don't have any specific complaints about him, his creature was not knocking me over. Now I see. Once again, Eva Green pulls off an entire hour with one other person, other than a minute or two of Seward, and slays. When you spend a full hour staring at two people's faces and can barely breathe, you know it's been an incredible show. The lighting, the blocking, and the shadows as effects were very theater-like, which is Kinnear's primary background. Perhaps not the most fantastical effects, but I think that was the point, and I'm okay with that. The love on the screen was just so heartbreaking. The sound of Vanessa scratching the vinyl. Ah! Vanessa marked JC like the devil marked the witches. Is he bound to her in some way now? Ooh, so that's kind of going along with what we were saying.
Mm-hmm.
How does she mark him, though?
She scratched his face.
Oh.
Yeah.
Duh. Okay. The poem, I Have a Little Shadow, so appropriate that I couldn't stop evil laughing. Whoa. Dracula calls her the wolf. This blew my mind, but I think a lot of the brothers' seduction of her and her response to them finally focuses on exactly what is inside Vanessa. We've talked before about the spirit of Lilith, and I think this is the most likely possibility given the information here. She was there in the beginning, before the fall of Lucifer and Dracula. They roamed the earth together. She is the wolf and the scorpion. Wolves were a favorite disguise of Lilith's spirit. I'm thinking this might not be the Hebrew version of Lilith, but an older cult of the primordial mother who gave birth to the first man. In Sumeria, she is the dark maid or a maiden of desolation, and her name means night creature. She is the darkness of the moon, a direct contrast to Ethan's wolf nature. Perfect? If she can overpower the brothers of darkness, her power must be greater than their simple perversion of goodness. I thought perhaps her spirit might even be the darkness that lay over the earth before the creation, which would not be inherently evil necessarily. It is as natural as a blade of grass, but it is pure darkness. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the spirit of God was hovering over the waters. This is Genesis 1 verses 1 and 2.
Yep.
I don't want to go on too long, but this is what I've primarily been ruminating on this week, so I'll leave it at that. Be what you are and always were. Double D's. P.S. Here's a link with some good Lilith info. Yeah, I think you're onto something, Donuts. That everything that you've listed about Lilith seems to fit perfectly. I'm definitely going to go to this link and check it out, and I will share it on our social network sites when I post this.
That's really great. I like all that stuff about Lilith. What about Brona being called Lily now?
Almost, oh, like Lilith?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good point.
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring that up because I did kind of think of Lily when Ives was fighting off Dracula and Lucifer because Lily eventually shirked off both Victor and John Clare last season because they were both essentially fighting over her too.
Yeah, but she fought off two goons while Vanessa's fighting off. Two badasses, you know.
I feel like I should say more about all that awesomeness that she just threw at us.
I know, right? We should just start the podcast with her letter and then move into it. Because there's a lot of really good points, and now I'm going to go and do a little homework myself. So thank you. It's always nice to have a little extra.
Yeah, and you guys should check out her blog if you like her emails and you haven't. I share them on our social networking sites, our Facebook and our Twitter. So, I mean, this is just a small portion of what she discusses about these episodes. So if you like her her emails, go and check them out at projectfandom.com. All right. Thanks, Donuts.
Thank you, Donuts.
Yeah, thanks a lot. All right. Next up is Wiley DeCody. She says, I'll get right to it and say this episode broke the chamber. 11 IV drips. It would be more, but it's a fitting karmic master number for precision. Like a great book or certain music, I could relive this sensation over and over. Who would have thought a semi-gothic whodunit horror with occasional well-placed humor and a new world Dracula and poetic yet cowering Lucifer would make me cry and leave me emotionally exhausted, even on a third watch, the repetition providing just enough understanding to its meter. For me, this episode was more in enjoying the emotional journey than understanding the exact what, why, or who. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. I mean, we try to suss out everything. That's the whole point of the podcast. But it is fun. We always watch it as fans first. We turn off the closed captioning and just kind of kick back and just absorb it. And that's the most fun watch. But she goes on to say, as Victor mentioned in Night Work, nature is rarely so precise and it abhors symmetry. Yet the timber and the stark white hexagon/hexagram flooring with white padded walls seems exactly like the perfection of a beehive. With Vanessa as its lone queen bee wishing to have died a virgin death like Joan of Arc. Enter two drones ready to take her if she would just say yes. My anticipation of Dr. Seward and John Clare for her was fulfilled. Thank you, God. Claire's death is still a mystery. In part, her time with him and his love of her may have caused it. I hope we find out this season. His post-orderly head has more stitches than Vanessa's, and he lost more memory than she had post-surgery. Yeah. To a degree, it's as if they switched places. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
His post-orderly head, I like that. As I mentioned, my Dracula, vampire, and Lucifer understandings are muddled. However, I was shocked to see Lucifer cornered by his brother. Counting Mina, Malcolm, Ethan, the puppet, and John Clare, the orderly, these fallen brothers have taken over a body. So is Dr. Sweet really Dracula? I must admit, I'm confused on this front. But that's okay because this episode was the magnum opus of the entire series. There's much more, but for a few days more, I'll let this one rest. I'm tired.
I didn't even... That thought never occurred to me if Dr. Sweet was really Dracula until we podcasted on this tonight. I don't know why, but I see why everybody's coming up with that because you see JC now being a puppet, so why could Dr. Sweet also be a puppet? But
I mean, granted, he does give his arm up for the thralls to drink out of. You know, he's like, here, have some of my blood.
Yeah.
So it could throw a kink in that, but at the same time, maybe he takes over Dr. Sweet's body long enough to where he's generating some kind of vampire gobbledygook. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So who knows? I mean, well, I'm sure next episode we'll get even more. I mean, it's just going to be a waiting game at this point.
So she says, good evening and thanks M. Stephen Paul and the rest of the community for adding another entree, the Cody. She says, postscript, M, you wanted me to remind you of the newspaper with Dr. Jekyll's name on it. The day after the murders in Night Work, the paper asked if Jack the Ripper was back. Suggests that Jekyll or Hyde was very near during the murders, though Ethan has claimed all of them. Big picture timeline. I have more detail, but here's a quick timeline. I think it works. Season 1, which would be September 22nd, 1891, starts, caption, first episode Night Work Ethan at Wild West Show. Season 2, Christmas Day of 1891, ends. Malcolm and Vanessa spoke of getting the boys to help with Christmas decor. Season 3, October 6th, 1892, starts the day Tennyson died. Estimate white padded room time ended shortly after 12/25, 1890. Surgery, another Christmas, 5 months, and time for her 1-inch hair to grow about 12 to 16 inches on back and walk on beach to see Mina asking for help. She goes straight to Malcolm in London to start season mm-hmm. 1. Cool.
Cool for mapping that out. Thank you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's fucking big awesome.
Time. So back up to the Dr. Jekyll thing. She had got a screen capture of the newspaper that was in Night Work, which is episode 1, season 1. And you see the headlines is asking if Jack the Ripper is back because of all the murdered bodies are popping up everywhere. But you see on the back page, because you have the newspaper opened up, and you see Dr. Jekyll's name up there.
Huh.
So, on the back page. So maybe Hyde's been around already. Maybe he's the one mm-hmm. responsible for those murders.
Maybe it's Dracula.
And she also shared a picture. There's a pillow you can buy through Showtime that has a picture of the scorpion. And it says something along the lines of, because we were focused on the snake, we forgot the scorpion. And I thought about that. And that makes me go, oh, so we're all like assuming Lucifer's possessing Ives, but maybe it's Aminette that takes over her body time to time.
I like it. I like it a lot.
Other than that, I don't know what the hell it means.
What it means is we're all focused on the devil, and Vanessa's just going to come up and start smacking people on the back of the head because you're not paying attention to the scorpion.
I think in our bonus podcast for season two, I predicted that she could be a big bad of a season coming up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think I even said maybe third season, so we'll see.
That would be...
It's too late. She would probably already start. Would have been
you never know. We could end the season with her becoming the big bad.
Yeah.
You know, she gives in to the Verbis Diablo and to her and becomes super, super Lilith.
Super Lily.
Yeah.
I think Dracula can be a lot. I don't know if he has the power to possess necessarily, but I think he has the power to change his appearance.
Yeah.
That would be more correct, because I think the devil's forte and wheelhouse would be possession. So he can go into other people's bodies and stuff like that. But Dracula, being a physical creature that he is, can't really simply possess somebody, I don't believe, but I don't necessarily know the rules. But he can make
this is like an ultra powerful Dracula too, though.
Yeah.
If you consider like the origin of him and everything, he's not just some, he's like an equal to Lucifer
right
at this point. So there's no telling what this Dracula can do. There's no telling what he looks like compared to the vampires we've seen in seasons past.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't even seen them, you know. So we really don't know. You know, I mean, after this episode and even the last one, I figured I'd take everything I knew about vampires and throw it away.
Yeah. You might as well, it's not all going to fit for sure.
Yeah, to make Dracula the brother of Lucifer, I absolutely love it, because it is. It's like a whole new character.
All right, well, that's it. Thank you, everybody, for writing in. Once again, we had a good time recording this podcast. We always look forward to doing this, and we'll be looking forward to talking to you again next week. All right. Mm-hmm. I am your host, Em.
I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Paul.
Be who you are. And wash your bums, all right? Everybody wash your butts out there.